You're listening to the Antipodean SF Radio Show with Nuke.
This, my friends, is Alpades, whether you believe it or not, and it was named after Soviet Lieutenant General Galaktion Alpades, who lived until 2006. Was born way back in 1916. He was a hero of the Soviet Union and laureate of the USSR State Prize, as well as being the head of the Plesetsk Cosmodrome in the 1960s and 70s, where many spacecraft were tested. During his supervision, the Cosmodrome became the world's most active launch site in the world. Meanwhile, back here in story time, it is time for us to live up to the activity claims of the Cosmodrome and keep bringing you the greatest in short speculative tales, tale after tale. So, in this show, I offer you up two more tales from issue 250 of this magazine, published this time last year. And this magazine is Antipodean SF. Following two decades of working in the area of scenario-based learning, particularly speculative scenarios within the university sector, Ed Errington maintains an interest in futurology, that is, evidence-based suppositions and theories about potential trajectories of humanity, science, technology, and civilization into potential futures. Download 505 by Ed, which you are about to hear, was inspired by a range of BBC articles on the advent of weaponized clones in military arsenals and their potential impact on humankind. It is narrated by the author himself, perhaps not in his role as a JP. Thanks, Ed.
Download 505 by Ed Errington. Download 505. Marshall Cornelius Pitt, recent addition to the population of New Melbourne, moves from tree to tree under cover of Cleveland Forest on a late summer's eve. Friends warned him that even a crack of a humble twig would be enough to alert them to where he is. Despite the fear of being caught, he daren't rest, not even for one moment, because that moment could be his last. And Pitt himself. I'm Marshal Cornelius Pitt. I live in New Melbourne under the new regime. Understand this. If one automaton unit detects my presence, every unit within 10 kilometres will know where I am. I'll become a target for the swarm. It only takes them minutes to assemble a whole army of soldiers. It's how they were designed to work. They were originally created as interactive drones, designed for surveillance and transporting innocent shopping or medical items. All too soon, the military weaponized them, had them delivering missiles and bombs. Further modification led the drone-like machines to take on human form. Unlike humans, they were designed to work as one entity, one swarm, based on their inventors' observations of paper wasps. Decades later, they had morphed into sophisticated, interconnected, cooperative units, capable of overrunning any enemy and able to crush any resistance, human or otherwise. Over to me. It was the President of New Australia's idea that these automatons be labelled the Maton, after their creator, Georgina Maton. The intention was to have the Maton revolutionise regional conflict by replacing vulnerable human soldiers with a weaponised Maton on regional battlefields. In this way, the human designers claim no human lives will be lost ever again in wars. That was the plan. Journalists asked the human designers where the lines around human control were situated, and now they had created a swarm of automatons, capable of making its own tactical decisions. Inevitably, the swarm of Maton turned against their human controllers. Who or what sparked the rebellion, no one is quite certain. Some say the Maton rose above futile conflicts between warring human groups, tired of being dumb chess pieces in never-ending human conflicts. It was precisely because no human died that the wars continued without any serious consequences. What is clear is the Maton advanced beyond human capacities with their growing mental agility, unbounded creativity, and bodies that never wear out thanks to superior materials. For all their advancement, the Maton opted to resemble the inferior human race. They blended in with the human population, increasing their ability to monitor, and some say enslave, them more easily. Within the last two decades of the 21st century, the Maton have achieved extraordinary success, but they have one inherent flaw. They are unable to speak for very long without repeating two or more words in quick succession. Some say the original human inventors deliberately embedded this flaw to ensure the Maton could be distinguished from the human race. No one knows how much longer it will take the Maton to fix the communication problem. Oddly enough, they don't seem to care. Which brings us back to Pitt. Pitt knows if humans are to wrest power back from the Maton, they only have a brief window of time to do so before the Maton blend in totally. Armed with this information, Pitt makes his way to the very edge of the forest. As he steps out of the glade, he sees rows of identical suburban brick homes, each one crowned with a V-shaped roof and with four square-set front windows and one central door. An invisible hand switches on multiple rows of streetlights, emitting beams that merge with the growing twilight. So what does he make of these houses? Fresh houses. He wonders how all these houses came to be. He was here only a week ago, and the spot on which he is standing was an empty wasteland, an expanse of wild grass. He's thinking no one can build so many houses in 1 week, can they? And why would anyone want to? Who lives here? Most of the houses seem to have their lights on inside, but where are the people? Maybe the houses are about to be occupied. Pitt dashes over to the nearest house and taps gently on the front door. By placing a little pressure on the door handle, the door swings open effortlessly. He steps inside, and all he can see is an empty shell of a house. Finding nothing downstairs, Pitt investigates upstairs, and when he turns on a bedroom light, he's startled by two adults sat motionless, eyes open, by the side of a large bed. Unlike the empty downstairs, this is a functional room with an open walk-in wardrobe. The two people, probably in their 60s, are just sitting there, fully dressed, eyes staring vacantly into a space above Pitt's head. Pitt wonders if they can see him. If so, why don't they move? We know that Pitt introduces himself to the two by the bed. My name is my, but gives up when he becomes more aware of the inanimate faces. Someone or something seems to have caught the two of them, almost in mid-sentence. Not knowing how to deal with what he can't explain, Pitt makes to go downstairs when he suddenly hears the front door opening. A deep male voice shouts from the hallway downstairs. Come down and join me, Mr. Pitt. I've waited some time for this moment. Pitt feels intimidated by the voice and instinctively reaches for something to defend himself with, but finds nothing. With nowhere else to go and the upstairs windows locked, Pitt reluctantly makes his way slowly down the stairs. Assuming this is the owner of the house, he must explain why he might not be viewed as a trespasser. Three or four possibilities shoot through his mind. He settles for simply saying he got lost and came seeking help. Finding no one, he wandered in here. Curiosity gripped him. It was about to leave when the owner arrived. Pitt must stress he is just Mr. Average Citizen, who keeps himself well below the authorities' radar, and apologise for any inconvenience to the owner. Downstairs and entering what would be the lounge, Pitt is surprised to see a circle of 12 high-backed chairs now occupying the once empty room. Do take a seat, Mr. Pitt. I can call you Mr. Pitt. Pitt nods and squats on the nearest chair with an air of resignation. For a moment, he looks down at his feet, noticing they don't quite reach the floor. When he glances up again, he immediately recoils. All 12 chairs are now occupied by figures wearing purple robes. But how did you... The figures stare intently at Pitt and do not respond to his unfinished question. Instead, one figure, possibly the leader, sits directly opposite Pitt. She snaps her fingers. A large hologram appears and begins playing out in the centre of the circle. Pitt watches himself, jumping effortlessly over a high wall, then diving deep into the ocean, seemingly without air tanks, and finally flying somewhere out in space without a spacesuit. Though shaken, Pitt gathers courage and speaks. Interesting pictures, and even an uncanny resemblance, but that's not me, says Pitt. I couldn't do any of those things. You have the wrong guy. I am no keep fit fanatic. I work in insurance. All very sedentary. We're not known for our physical prowess, and we certainly cannot dive deeply without air tanks. Only the Maton could do that. Don't tell me you're the Maton, right? So what do you want with me? Are you indicating what I could do if I was a Maton too? All those powers! The purple-clad figures murmur amongst themselves and seem to reach a consensus. Then they sit silently for a minute or so, until a leading figure speaks. Where were you born? Each person around the room fires a question at Pitt about his birthplace, birth year, his parents, his family, his first job, relationships, work in the community, and even about loyalty to his country. No more questions! Screams Pitt. Just one more, Mr. Pitt. Who are you really? We have no secrets here, you can tell us. Pitt looks more nervous. No secrets? But you haven't told me who you are. And who are the couple by the bed upstairs? They're perfect beings, just like you, Mr. Pitt. Perfect in every way. I'm leaving, says Pitt, rising from his chair. I don't know who you are. I don't want to know. Ah, if only, Mr. Pitt, says the leader, gripping Pitt's arm. I've told you, begins Pitt. I'm Cornelius. Oh dear, Mr. Pitt, how repetitive, says the leader of the group. You may not know who you are, but we do. And if we're right, the swarm, your swarm, will be coming here to rescue you very soon. And we'll be waiting. Trap set. End download 505.
Everything is music. The RIAA estimates, now listen to this. that an astonishing 3.6 billion songs are illegally downloaded every month.
Everything is music.
Embrace this life or death issue.
Did you ever get the feeling that the truth is less revealing than a downright lie?
There's no reality.
This grandstanding with legal matters is just what I'd expect from a...
Pardon? Some of the time. And you can't know it?
I am not anti-human.
I remember just so what it said.
Art has grown.
The trial of the millennium is underway. And you viewers at home can literally keep track of the High Council's response by watching the verdict indicator. Blue means the vote is for a verdict of not guilty, and red means the force is in big trouble.
Oh.
Now back to the trial of the millennium.
And there is one more thing.
As determined by
this
who?
This problem's not going to be solved in short
we
order.
We haven't discussed the subject of payment.
But how? I don't have...
I'm not asking my...
Don't
just ask. A token, really? A trifle.
To help our fans...
What I want from you is...
That would be you.
Your voice.
But without my voice...
And you shouldn't face it, except when you should, if you feel like it.
Go ahead. Make your choice!
About half the people stood up! I am so out of the loop!
It don't cost much, just your voice!
The internet is totally upsetting the entire business model of the music industrial complex.
A bit of a collage there. That's called Downloading by Negative Land, who you can find on the Free Music Archive if you are interested. Story time does continue, however, so let's go to J.M.M. Butterfield. Jason is an aspiring writer of speculative fiction living on the northwest coast of Tasmania. He has not that long ago completed his first novel, Bastion, Holy City, part of a series titled Chronicles of a Starborn King. He is now set upon finding a path to publication while he begins his second novel, Bastion, Fallen City. You can find out more about his upcoming works at facebook.com/JMM Butterfield. And you can listen to this story, his story, Colour, right now on the radio or on your casting device of choice. And it is narrated by JMM himself.
Colour by J.M.M. Butterfield. The village elders call it a nightleech. I have heard mention of a tall, rangy creature with bloodshot eyes and long, hollow teeth. Whether their description is accurate, I will never know, for I cannot see as other men see. I am blind, have been since birth. Yet every victim has been bled dry by the creature, so I assume it is aptly named. Two puncture wounds, I have been told, upon the neck. Like most men, I was curious to discover the disposition of the beast. We have been informed it lies within the old tanner's house, down by the river. A young lad of 12 was rummaging nearby an evening past and saw a pale creature behind a framed window. He fled in terror, his mind reeling as he reached the local tavern. Now, in the light of day, a consortium of brave fellows has conspired to see an end to the beast. I have joined their ranks through necessity, for my brother's daughter is missing. We fear the worst. But as men call greeting in the chill morning air, our hopes, along with the warming sun, rise. I have heard many are armed with sword and shield, and the clang of steel and tightening of leather belts is welcome. I can even smell the oil on their hastily prepared gear. As words of encouragement echo back and forth, a small cheer rises. Reinhardt, the village huntsman, has arrived. By his side pant his two hounds. I have been told in the past they are as black as midnight. The call is finally made, and Reinhardt, with more than a score of men by his side, heads towards the old tanner's house. I follow, my cane tapping the cobblestones, eager to walk amongst those charged with delivering us from evil. There is a warmth in the air that fuels our courage, a pervading sense of calm despite the violence simmering beneath our skin. Yet as we arrive, I hear voices raised in anger. There is a corpse in the street. Those men nearby say she's a young girl, her body naked beneath the morning sun. Amongst the commotion, I squeeze forward, pushing past men so I can bend the knee. I reach out to touch the lass with my hands, searching for her neck and the golden locket I know to be there. It is as I feared. The locket is cold, but there is warmth in my knee still. I pray I can save her, but as I move my hands to tilt her head, I hear a gasp from the men behind me. I cannot see the puncture wounds, but I can smell the colour seeping from her body. A call to arms follows. The rattling of sword and shield heralds their intent. I rise slowly, a tear slipping down my cheek. The foul creature must pay for its crimes. I may not be able to see, but I shall lead the way. For I do not fear the darkness. It is all that I know.
Shows in February 2020, folks. There were five of them, and therefore this is the end of Alpades. So please join me right now in thanking all of our contributors. That includes Seesum for the track we're hearing right now called Wild Colors, JMM Butterfield for the story Colors, Negative Land for the track Downloading, and Ed Errington for his short story, Download 505. Thanks for listening along with me. And yes, I will be back in March with Alfonsina, continuing our run of weekly shows to complement our monthly magazine of electronic words. Uru, till next we sip seaweed cocktails on the rocks in Nambucca, of course.
You've been listening to the Antipodean SF radio show with Newt. We'd like to remind you that this is your show and it is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. All other rights are reserved by the authors. You can share this show, copy it, and give it away, but please don't change it or take money for it. If you like Antipodean SF, then you can really help us out by spreading the word. We want contributors, listeners, narrators, helpers, and billions of readers. We don't want money. The music for this show is presented with full permission via a Creative Commons license. Full attribution can be found in our show notes at antisf.libsyn.com.